Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
gold rush. Police finally announce arrests in that $20 million airport gold heist in Toronto last year. The Peel police chief reveals the key clue that broke the case.
Taken by storm, dozens are dead after heavy rains flood parts of Pakistan, and there's more rain still to come. One survivor tells us he's never seen such devastation.
Down for the count, a BBC reporter did not buy the Kremlin's claims about Russian casualties in Ukraine. So she and her colleagues teamed up with some independent journalists to calculate the true toll.
The stuff that dreams were made of. Terry Fox's family finds a home for thousands of mementos from his life, which is a huge relief to his brother Daryl since they were languishing in a storage locker.
On his bets behavior, the NBA bans former Toronto Raptor Jontay Porter for life for allegedly scheming to fix sports wagers, including betting on his own team to lose.
And the Big Bang Theory. To celebrate the end of winter, the people of Zurich gather around a burning snowman called the Bug and wait for his head to explode. But this year, the wind took the wind out of their sails. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that always blows minds. They rolled in with an empty truck and rolled out with more than 6,000 bars of pure gold. It's been a year since the largest gold heist in Canadian history, and today, police announced they had cracked the case. Nine people are facing charges in connection with the heist, including two Air Canada employees and one suspect arrested in the U.S. with dozens of illegal guns in his vehicle. It's thought that the thieves used some of the melted down gold to buy firearms. Nishan Duryapa is the chief of Peel Regional Police. We reached him in Mississauga, Ontario.
Chief, there are certainly always layers to an investigation, but in this case, was there a clue, was there a moment or a break that finally led you to these arrests?
Yes, in this particular one, everything started with the driver of the truck that physically picked up the gold. You know, to begin to describe how many kilometers officers went kind of door-to-door to piece the direction of travel of one vehicle was really quite significant. And, you know, once we were able to see the vehicle and identify the driver, everything became really clear. And after that, sort of the dominoes started to fall.
If we go back to April 17, 2023, I remember our coverage from that day and all the questions that everybody who heard the story had, you know, that it was likely an inside job. How could this happen? You have to have a document to get access to this kind of shipment. And there was a document. What was
yes.
it? Where did it come from?
You're absolutely right. This could not have began or been initiated without individuals understanding the internal mechanisms of how cargo gets released, how it looks legitimate upon release. And so what you do have is individuals that were able to, you know, use legitimate documentation clearly in a false manner. And what it is a cargo release document that is stamped. It's typewritten, looks exactly the way it should be. Anybody, you know, processing it may, whether they were compliant or complicit or not, would never know otherwise. So the reality is that somebody who knows the internal workings of how cargo may be released exploited some of the vulnerabilities that existed in the system.
Is your investigation saying or suggesting that these were forged documents or just a copy of a document from a shipment the day before, a fish shipment, I think it was?
No, in this particular case, the document that we featured today is a forged document on legitimate, you know, the paper used that somebody would use to actually, if you're, you know, attending to release furniture that you had shipped from overseas, it's on the right documentation, but it was done fraudulently. And there are multiple gates to get through to have something like this released. And the second individual also from involved that was an employee had the ability to populate the documentation with the right information because he had access to all that data too. So it would be virtually impossible maybe to come in and achieve that off the curb or off the street. But, you know, it starts with people in an organized and coordinated fashion that were able to do so. You know, just to highlight that, the cargo wasn't even on ground for more than a few hours before this was executed, right?
And you believe that the two Air Canada employees played a big role in everything that happened and a lot of what you just outlined there. Does it surprise you that there were not better checks and balances, better protections in place? It certainly surprised us, you know, all of us on the outside.
That is for that organization to explore how the checks and balances that were needed in processes. Listen, just to be fair, I think the world is full of complex processes, which, you know, I think if you've got the insider line of sight, you would know where there are weaknesses, right? So maybe not unique to just the cargo entity itself, but it would clearly be an area of focus without a doubt to rectify moving forward.
One of the people arrested was arrested in the United States with dozens of illegal guns in the vehicle. That's another layer to this case that might surprise people. What does that suggest to you about what all of this gold was being used for?
Yeah, so, you know, the clear for the public to know, it's not just one victim who was out over $20 million in gold and currency. What it indicates is that the theft itself is directly linked to organized criminal activity in so many different areas. The profits of the sale of the gold, very clearly, in this case, the U.S. individual arrested was transporting and importing firearms back into Canada. So the cash was used to finance that. And so I think for the public to understand that, you know, these things don't happen in isolation, and the ripple effects are seen in an organized fashion in so many different ways.
And what do you think that would have meant to people in Ontario to have those kinds of weapons on the streets here?
Well, we know, thanks to our colleagues in the ATF and Pennsylvania law enforcement, that the individual who we were looking for as in relation to the theft found with 66 firearms, a large amount of them were fully automatic pistols converted and machine guns. I can just tell you, like, imagine what that would mean on the streets of Canada, GTA. That's 66 firearms that are not able to be used in a carjacking, auto theft, a robbery, drug transaction. It means that it saved lives. So it goes to show you that sometimes the most sensational criminal activities, like the gold heist, actually has a dotted line to compromising public safety in a way that affects you, myself, our families on a day-to-day basis.
I know you've recovered as well hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash, some gold bracelets, I believe, as well. But where is the rest of all of that gold, those bars?
We believe, and I think the investigators believe, that what has happened to the gold and what we believe, because we have evidence of the melting pots, and et cetera, were melted and sold and redistributed potentially internationally. So the small amount of gold that we've recovered is sort of an artifact of the whole criminal activity. The cash is some of the profits. We're not likely to find the gold in its current state. Gold has really no DNA the moment it's melted. There's no way of correlating it back to the original amount. The serial numbers are clearly all gone. So our current and ongoing activity is to look to see where proceeds of these individuals may show up, the financial rewards, and then work it backwards from there. But we do believe that the gold, probably in a very short time, has been sold on an international market.
Chief, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Neil. Have a great day.
Nishan Duryappa is the chief of Peel Regional Police. We reached him in Mississauga, Ontario. Olga Ivshina has been checking Vladimir Putin's math. Ms. Ivshina is a senior reporter with the BBC's Russian service. She and her colleagues wanted an accurate count of Russian losses in Ukraine. So far, the Kremlin has only acknowledged 6,000 deaths, but that seemed low. So Ms. Ivshina and her colleagues teamed up with the independent Russian outlet Mediazona and some brave fact finders to see how many they could verify themselves. We reached Olga Ivshina in London.
Olga, according to your investigation with your colleagues, how many Russian soldiers have died?
So together with our colleagues from independent Russian website Mediazona, we have now confirmed names of 50,000 Russian soldiers who died fighting in Ukraine, and this is based on open source information only.
That is more than eight times the most recent figures that the Kremlin has released. What does the size of that number, 50,000 people, what does that tell you?
It actually tells us a lot about how Russia and Russian forces and Russian tactics is changing over these 2 years of the invasion, because it's not just some estimates. These are confirmed numbers. So first of all, it puts a bare minimum for Russian losses. Secondly, it's definitely not the full number, but thousands of those stories put together help us understand some of the trends. And I guess the most important trend is that in the second 12 months of fighting, Russia has lost more troops, 25% more troops than during the first year of the invasion. And this shows us a significant change in Russian tactics. It seems during the first year of the invasion, they were heavily relying on their professional soldiers deployed to carry out quite complex tactical operations. But by the end of the first year of the invasion, most of those soldiers were injured or killed or left the army. So after that, Russia started sending thousands of unprepared and not well-trained troops into human wave attacks forward towards Ukrainian positions in order to wear them down and identify Ukrainian artillery spots. And soldiers themselves call it the mid-grinder tactics.
It's such a horrible term, but it does illustrate what you're saying and what your numbers have revealed. Meat grinder tactics. We also heard so much about forced recruitment. Alexei Prigozhin, the Wagner Brigade. What happened to them?
Yes, you are right. Prisoners are crucial to that new Russian strategy. We see that at the moment they constitute at least 20% of the losses confirmed, of the Russian losses confirmed by us. They have also took part in all major battles of 2023. It seems prisoners are recruited and sent to the very first lines of the front line. So they are used to physically identify Ukrainian positions, to wear them down, and also to help Russian artillery to target those, regardless of the human cost of such an operation. And because of the sheer numbers which Russia is now able to put on the front line, these tactics seem to provide Russia limited territorial gains in different parts of the front line.
Beyond the prisoners that you talked about there, what else have you been able to learn about where these 50,000 soldiers came from?
So the majority of them have come from within Russia, but not only. We have identified more than 300 citizens of different foreign countries who died fighting for Russia in Ukraine. Most of those confirmed figures come from Central Asia, but there are also countries which are situated way further. For example, Nepal, several soldiers from Africa, from Syria, at least one soldier from Iraq. So it's quite a geography, and this tells you a lot about Russian war effort, about their effort to recruit more and more troops to send them to the front line, because that meat grinder tactics, it costs them a lot in both soldiers and equipment. And also our research, for example, has shown that half of the prisoners from our sample have only survived 3 months on the front line.
What are people in Russia hearing? I mean, obviously they're hearing much lower numbers, and you're in London, but from your research and what you know, what are people there hearing about who is on the front line?
It seems to be a mixed situation. First of all, it depends which region you live in. If it's region which is in which certain military units are based, then you sort of feel the scale of losses because someone you know was in war, maybe they're injured, maybe they were killed. But for those regions which are situated a bit further from Russian borders, where there are no big military unit formations, they seem to be less aware of the situation. And also, it's important to mention that people seem to know more or less about casualties from their immediate surroundings, but most of Russians seem not to be aware of the general picture of this total scale of the losses.
And what is the age range of these soldiers?
The youngest soldier died just 3 months after he turned 18 years old, and the oldest soldier, we have confirmed, died at the age of 71. So it's absolute mix of biographies and paths of life. The average fighter at the moment seems to be 36 years old, and most commonly it's a prisoner from Western Siberia. At the start of the invasion, the average soldier was 21-year-old paratrooper who signed a contract, professional contract, with the Russian army a few months or even a few years before the invasion.
You know, you mentioned you looked at open source data, you worked with other journalists, independent journalists, but just for you personally, you know, what has it been like to dig through all of this and spend so much time trying to get this information?
Well, I guess it was hard, but what motivates us is that if we don't do it, there is a possibility that we'll never know even this absolute conservative figure till the end of our lives. The thing is that most of the countries are quite secretive about their war losses during the time of fighting, but then they more or less release the figures. It's a different story with Russia. They have been secretive about their war losses for years and even decades after the fighting has been over. We have seen the same picture with the war in Chechnya, with a war in Afghanistan, and even with a World War II, there are still some gaps, still some information missing about those killed and missing in action. So the biggest motivation for me personally was that, you know, if I'm not doing it, probably I'll till the rest of my life, I won't know even the approximate figure of those dead.
Olga, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Olga Ivshina is a senior reporter with the BBC's Russian service. We reached her in London. Terry Fox is a national hero, so it's only fitting that thousands of mementos from his life have been given a new home, including cards and letters he received during his marathon of hope and in the months after he had to cut his run short. His cancer had returned, but as he got treatment, he remained in the spotlight. There was a telethon, he received the Order of Canada and other accolades, and he got messages of support from across the country. That's when former As It Happens host Barbara Frum spoke to Terry Fox at his home in Port Coquitlam, B.C.
Every day I got all kinds of mail, and I always read every letter that I get, and the kinds of things that people say and encourage me and support me really help me out psychologically, because I know there's so many people pulling for me, and that just makes it easier to go from day to day. And I also, I have a belief in God, and that no matter what happens to me, things are going to be okay, because, you know, it doesn't matter whether the cancer spreads or not, because either way, I'm going to turn out a winner. I'm going to either go to heaven, or I'm going to continue doing what I'm right now, and not dwelling on the fact that, there is uncertainty, and just thinking positively is the way you got to take it.
You know, you mentioned the telethon, you mentioned working with other patients that have got cancer. But there's a whole second thing that you've done, and I guess you're aware of that kind of symbolic thing about the country, about running across.
Mm-hmm.
I realize that fighting cancer is your uppermost thought, but what you've done for this country's sense of itself and what its people can be, I hope people have made that clear to you, too.
Well, I have, you know, in the letters in the mail, I hear that, too, and that's something I never ever dreamed of. I never ever planned to do that.
That was Terry Fox talking to former As It Happens host Barbara Frum in December 1980, about 6 months before his death. Now, those letters and other memorabilia from Terry Fox's life will be preserved at the Royal BC Museum in Victoria. Daryl Fox is Terry's brother. We reached him in Chilliwack, BC.
Daryl, it kind of takes my breath away to hear the voice of Terry Fox again and such powerful things he said. Do you remember that interview?
I do remember that interview, and why did you play it? It's very emotional to hear Terry's voice, you know, 44 years removed from the Marathon of Hope. You know, I have a thirst for all things Terry, and to hear him speak in that way is extremely emotional. And that was probably one of the last interviews Terry gave. Those words are incredibly powerful, and as he said, he didn't recognize the impact he was having on people beyond just the fundraising for cancer research. And I think that was quite an interesting perspective and a great question that Barbara asked at that time.
Yeah, it certainly was. Did your family take strength from those letters as well?
Oh, obviously we did. Hence the reason why they still exist, you know, 44 years later. You know, kudos to Mom who recognized, you know, that there was value and a need to protect these letters and these words. And we don't know how many we have, actually, Neil. You know, we thought there was 50,000, but more recently we had all the letters and cards scanned, and apparently there's close to 300,000. So somewhere between 50,000 and 300,000. But it just shows how Terry touched people back in 1980, and they needed to express their thoughts about Terry. And they did so in a really big way back then.
And still touches people, as you well know.
Yeah, I'm obviously a little close, a little biased here, but, you know, I have an incredible gift. I get to take this in, this legacy, and I think it's as vibrant now as it was in the 80s, post-Marathon of Hope. Mm-hmm. Terry is not here, but he's everywhere. You know, in the last year and a bit, I've been to London, England, Ireland, Malaysia, Singapore, Brazil, and more recently the French Polynesian Islands for Terry Fox. And to see how he's affecting and impacting on people beyond Canada is really powerful.
There's much more to the collection. That's such a huge part of it, as you said. But what else is going to the Royal BC Museum now?
Well, everything. So it's been a bit of a challenge for us at this time. The collection is in a locker, a storage locker, not the best environment. So really happy and pleased that everything we have will be heading over from the Lower Mainland to Victoria in the next few months. I think it's in pretty good shape in terms of how it's atomized. But again, you know, the preservation and the climate is not right. So really looking forward to that move and that day when it's over in Victoria.
I think a lot of listeners will be surprised that not only that it was in a locker, as you said, but that it hasn't been on display in a museum in all of these years because of Terry's impact. Why do you think it's taken this long for a museum to take it all in?
You know, we have had exhibits over the years. Mm-hmm. You know, we've partnered with the Canadian Museum of History for the 35th anniversary, and we created an exhibit that was very well received, so well received that we decided that we should see it travel. So it traveled for 3 years, and actually one of the last visits was of Royal BC Museum, and then it went back in a box. And then we've had the van touring and visiting locations over the years as well. Again, this is a very big step, first step, in terms of making sure that the collection is protected and preserved. But it's no good in a box. We know how the collection can inspire and motivate people, and we look forward to having that conversation with RBCM and others going forward.
I'm glad you mentioned the van, the iconic van. You were there. You accompanied your brother during the marathon. You were certainly in that van. What are some of your memories?
yeah, many memories from that stinky Ford van. So when we did find it in 2007, and Ford was kind enough to fully restore it, one thing we didn't bring back was the odor.
Yeah, so I think I remember that. I was at the press conference for that unveiling in 2007, I think, when I worked at News Network. I remember.
So, yeah, we left the odor back in 1980. It was absolutely, I mean, three young men, one of them running a marathon every day. It had a porta potty as well and a bunch of stinky clothing. So, well, that van was Terry's Marathon of Hope home. That was his office. That's where he slept most nights. There was the opportunity for donated accommodations during the Marathon of Hope, but Terry always preferred the van and the van bed because it was a bed that he was familiar with. So nothing but very strong memories of that van because it was there for every mile, 3,039 miles. So it was there. And so I look at it and immediately it's right back to 1980 in the road.
BC's Minister of Sport, Lana Popham, told the Globe and Mail recently that when she saw Terry's shoes in person, it brought her to tears. So I wonder what you think it will mean for people, not only to see his shoes, but, you know, his prosthetic leg, the water he took at the start of his race off the coast of Newfoundland, at the start of his run. Why do you think those things mean so much to people and move people to tears all these years later?
You know, I think it's a way to share and inspire. And as Mom said, you know, Betty Fox said in 2011, 13 years ago, and this was 6 months before she passed, you know, there's going to come a time in the not-too-distant future when those of us who witness the Marathon of Hope won't be able to share and speak to what Terry accomplished. And now we're 13 years later. We're all getting older. How is that story going to be shared? And I know and I've seen how the artifacts can communicate and share a story. You know, look at the sock that Terry wore on his artificial leg. He never took it off. You know, throughout the Marathon of Hope, even post-Marathon of Hope when Terry was forced to stop running, he kept that sock on his shoe because he thought there was a chance that he could get out there and finish the run. And it was only in late December of 1980 when I think he accepted and recognized his fate that he took the sock off and buried it in the back of his sock drawer because Mom was on him all the time. I want to wash this sock. Get it off.
Mom's always, yeah.
Of course she did. So, and it was only after, you know, after she was obviously cleaning up things and in that sock drawer and she found it and she had recognized the significance of it and decided this thing is going to stick around forever and because it can share a story and one I just shared.
Daryl, I'm so glad we could speak. I hope that clip off the top wasn't too upsetting. I really appreciate your time and your stories.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you.
Daryl Fox is Terry Fox's brother and a senior advisor at the Terry Fox Research Institute. He's in Chilliwack, BC.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Sami Uddin says he has never experienced a flash flood this bad in the Lower Chitral district of Pakistan. Over the past few days, Pakistan and Afghanistan have been hit by heavy rains and flooding so intense that it has destroyed homes and caused the deaths of more than 100 people. The flooding continues to spread in the northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, where Sami Uddin says aid has yet to reach his community. He and his family had to leave their home to survive. We reached Mr. Uddin in Lower Chitral, Pakistan.
Sami, can you tell us what it was like once the rain started to fall?
So it was 11th of April. The rain started here. Yeah. During the floods, the main thing was there was, it's a mountainous area. The rock falling, it was a terrible scene. The kids, after every 5 minutes, there was like a bombardment. The rocks, the stones were falling down on the mountains. The villagers were getting out from their house, coming to safe places. The kids, the children were weeping. They were crying. They were totally in fear. It was a terrible scene. It was a terrible scene, absolutely. We haven't heard such a rain. It was more than 100 hours rain, which haven't heard in a history of Chitral, that such type of rain in this season, in the month of April, we haven't received such rains. It was terrible, absolutely.
What is left of your village right now?
The infrastructure has washed out. The irrigation channels, there is no irrigation, no drinking water available to us now. The electricity is, there is no electricity. The crops, the standing crops of our village, they are totally washed out. The fruits, they were in bloom. They were ready. They were, I think, we are totally dependent on the fields, on the crops, and on the fruits, and on the cattle, etc. They totally washed out there. It was a big loss. The kids were psychologically so much depressed that their faces were pale. They were very in fear.
It's traumatic for anyone, especially children. What happened, Sami, to your home?
Our homes, as you know, they are not made of concrete or strong houses. They are built of stone slags or muddy houses. Mm-hmm. Few of them are completely damaged, but most of them are partially damaged. Some have boundary walls fallen.
What about yours? Is yours still standing?
My house is not fully damaged also, although it's partially damaged. There are cracks. There are walls fallen down. So I still can pass my life in this broken house still.
Did you have any warning from officials or anyone that this dangerous situation was coming?
We have got through social media that we have district management's disaster management's. We have provincial PDMA, provincial disaster management authority. We have got messages from these institutions before, but we were not expecting such heavy, such terrible rains.
So they were giving you warnings, but they didn't say how bad it was going to be? Or you didn't believe the warnings?
We didn't believe. Actually, we didn't believe. So they're warning every time, so we didn't believe.
There was flooding, I think, in 2022. What made this one so different? That was terrible as well. 2 years ago, but what was different this time?
It was a bit different. 2022, it was mostly glacier burst. So this was flash floodings. Every side, every year in the mountains, the water was coming down. The flooding was not so dangerous. It was the rock falling, the stones coming from the mountains. It was very dangerous. It was like a jet bombardment, fighter bombardment we were hearing. So our houses are right on the bottoms of these mountains. So every now and then we were getting out from their houses, came to the roads, and the kids were crying, etc., this type.
How do you feel about the government's preparedness for these kinds of issues? Global climate change, it's clearly having an impact, a very direct impact on your lives year after year. This one, the worst you've experienced, you said. Do you think the government is doing enough there to make sure villages like yours are safe?
I think countries like Pakistan and like the district Chitral we are living, we are too much poor. We are dependent on totally other countries or other organizations. So I blame government, but not much. I blame other international communities, other international donors, agencies, or other organizations who are doing not much for us. I want more assistance from World Food programs. I want other United Nations agencies and others World International Agencies to inject, to give cash to the pupils to change their standard of life. There are malnutrition, nutrition deficiencies in these areas. So crops are destroyed, fruit are destroyed. So I think in this nutrition fields that they need to inject some finance.
Sami, thank you for your time. I'm glad you and your family are okay.
Thank you very much once again. I am very thankful to you, to your whole teams, that you are touching in such a worse situation with us.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Sami Uddin is one of the victims of the flash floods in Pakistan. We reached him in Lower Chedral earlier today. Western countries are calling for moderation, but Israel says it will make its own decisions when it comes to defending itself. Today, foreign ministers from Britain and Germany traveled to Israel. They urged the government to respond with restraint after Iran launched a missile attack against Israel on Saturday. Here's the UK's David Cameron speaking to reporters.
The situation is very concerning. It's right to show solidarity with Israel. It's right to have made our views clear about what should happen next. But it's clear the Israelis are making a decision to act. We hope they do so in a way that does as little to escalate this as possible, and in a way that, as I said yesterday, is smart as well as tough.
The UK's Foreign Minister David Cameron speaking today. Danny Danon is an Israeli MP with the Likud party. He told the BBC why he thinks a response is inevitable.
We have to retaliate. The question is how we do it, when we do it, against whom. But I don't think we can sit idly by after the attack. Iran chose to send those rockets, missiles and UAVs from Iran. For many months and years, they used their proxies in the region. They built a very massive force around Israel. But they decided to escalate. They decided to create a new equation by sending all of those rockets from Iran into Israel.
They decided to escalate, you say. How would you characterize bombing a diplomatic building, a consulate in Damascus, which houses Iranian officials and, of course, enjoys the status of sovereign Iranian territory?
Well, first, I would say it very clear that we haven't taken responsibility for the attack. Second,
Mr. Danon, I think we're beyond those sort of obfuscations.
Second, it wasn't a consulate. You know, when you look at the pictures and the data, it was a building next to a consulate. It wasn't part of an embassy or a consulate. And third, even if it happened, can it justify attack of ballistic missiles into a country, into Jerusalem, our capital, into military bases and very sensitive facilities we have in Israel? I don't think you can put it as a rational reaction. Even if they believe that we did it and they want to retaliate, you don't send ballistic missiles like that. The intentions of Tehran was to kill Israelis, was to target our facilities. That is something we cannot accept. We have to build our deterrence.
The question is, how you respond, both when and where?
So I can tell you that our government is a responsible government. Prime Minister Netanyahu is very experienced. That is why I don't expect that we will take any crazy decisions. Make it very clear. It is a sophisticated decision because we don't want a full war with Iran. But at the same time, we need to find the smart way to make sure that the leaders of Iran will think very carefully next time before they give the orders to send ballistic missiles and cruise missiles into Israel.
Danny Danon is an Israeli MP with the Likud party. He was speaking to Stephen Sacker, host of Hard Talk on the BBC. he forgot a pretty simple rule. When you go double or nothing, there's always the risk of winding up with nothing. The NBA has banned Toronto Raptors center Jontay Porter for life. The league announced the ban after an investigation into irregularities around bets connected to Mr. Porter. It found that he had disclosed confidential information to bettors, limited his own participation for betting purposes, and bet on NBA games himself. When the investigation opened, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver called the accusations, quote, a cardinal sin, unquote. Declan Hill has written two books on gambling and sports. We reached him in New Haven, Connecticut.
Declan, in your view, does the punishment here, a lifetime ban, fit the crime?
Look, they have to do something. The visuals on this, Neil, are just so bad. You've got an extraordinary series of coincidences, extraordinary amounts of money in these bets. So the NBA really has to take a stern, draconian approach to this. The visuals are just so bad on it otherwise.
One of these bets on a game in late January was the most profitable bet in the NBA. I've been looking at the details, but for those who don't know exactly what went on in that bet, give them a glimpse.
Well, look, first of all, let's just start with your statistic. I mean, there are hundreds of millions of dollars bet every week on the NBA. So if it's the most profitable, that's saying a lot. This isn't some small bush league. This is really one of the top leagues in the world. And so this was their most profitable bet in a week. And then it was repeated a few weeks later. So the chances of that coincidence happening are truly extraordinary. It was what's called in the betting market a parlay bet, and it was on an underperformance. So it's really difficult for a player to guarantee that they overperform. You know, I'm going to play the next game, and I'm going to score more points than you think I am or the betting market thinks I am. But in this case, every single one in the parlay bet, that's a series of bets one after the other, was all on Jontay Porter's underperforming what the market was going to say. And lo and behold, both on January 26th and March 20th, he did exactly that. Doesn't mean he's guilty, but it is an extraordinary coincidence that causes all kinds of people in the gambling market to raise their eyebrows very, very high indeed.
And one of them, one bet, it would have been an $80,000 bet that he would not hit the numbers set by the online sports book for the parlays, and that bet would have won $1.1 million. According to one story I'm reading. If this was an even bigger player, a huge name in the NBA, do you think the league would have cracked down this hard?
Look, I'm not sure about that. I don't like talking about conjectures, but I do know that this is tip of the iceberg stuff. I'm doing research on my next book, and the stuff that's coming out from the illegal bookmakers, from the police that are monitoring this. And no, these are the police, not the National Basketball Association or any of the betting companies they pay or receive sponsorship from. Is some really extraordinary stuff. We have a problem with gambling addiction. There's far too many young players. Again, I'm not suggesting Jontay Porter is a gambling addict, but there's far, far too many of our current generation of athletes that are utterly addicted to gambling.
Are there no safeguards, Declan, to combat that? Why do you think there is such a prevalence of that, of gambling, among young male athletes in particular?
Look, I'm sorry to laugh, but like every time you turn on the TV now, there's an avalanche of gambling. You walk into the stadium, there's, you know, it's just an inundation of gambling ads. The North American sports leagues are dancing with the devil. They've signed all these deals with bookmakers. And the players are there. The players are as tempted as anyone else. You know, why wouldn't they is what they're thinking. I mean, you're taking the sponsorship from these guys. Why wouldn't I bet? And the issue with young athletes is they have exactly the same proclivity as gambling addicts. The very things that make them good as sports people, they never give up. They're obsessive. They think they can overturn odds, make them really, really right in the target zone to being a gambling addict. It makes them terrible gamblers. It makes them lose a lot of stuff. And this is a huge issue.
Those ads are certainly prevalent in Ontario. You see famous people, famous athletes in them as well. So I hear what you're saying, certainly. What do you think the leagues, the NBA, but other sports leagues, because it's certainly not just the NBA, what do they need to do if they want fans to have the faith?
They need to put clear blue water between themselves and bookmaking companies. Again, for anyone outside of the sports world, is going to be shocking. Sports fans who are listening to us will kind of know this, but there are official bookmaker sponsors of these sports leagues. How is somebody to look at a game and say, hey, did that amazing play happen because it was in the, you know, because it was sports? Or did somebody preordain this because it's on the gambling market? And literally all our North American professional sports have signed these deals with bookmakers. They haven't put in proper regulation, and they really haven't taken it seriously. The second issue is that our federal government has not done enough to protect Canadian sports. When the Trudeau government brought in 2 years ago the legalization of professional sports, which I agree with, they did not do the necessary change in the criminal code, which was to make match fixing illegal. I've spoken to a number of my law enforcement sources on this particular story, and their response was, even if John Tay Porter was guilty, or even if there was something that we could do, something was going on there, we could not even begin the investigation because it wouldn't be illegal in Canada.
When you hear or read that Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, says, quote, there's nothing more important than protecting the integrity of NBA competition for our fans, our teams, and everyone associated with our sport. And he goes on to say why he's brought in this ban for Jontay Porter. When you hear that, do you believe that they are taking this seriously?
I've actually had my finger over my mouth because I didn't want to laugh, but I am now literally rolling on the floor with laughter. I'll get up and answer the question. But Adam Silver is saying the NBA's first goal is to protect the integrity. Adam Silver, for the last 10 years, has been touting having deals with bookmakers in the sports gambling market. So it's clearly not their number one issue. It's one of their top issues, but it's not the top one. The NBA and all the American and North American and Canadian professional sports leagues have to put separation between themselves and bookmakers. Otherwise, really good faith, reasonable fans, not conspiracy theorists, will be looking at all kinds of plays, be looking at all kinds of sports events, and will say, this just cannot be happening. This is some kind of theatrical, you know, event connected with the sports gambling world.
Declan, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Declan Hill leads the Sports Integrity Center at the University of New Haven, and that's where we reached him. Last year, it all went beautifully. The horses galloped around the burning pyre while the children screamed happily. The snowman burst into flame exactly as planned. And then the crowd was given the magical gift it has yearned for and received every year for centuries. The snowman's head triumphantly exploded, whereupon everyone cheered and roasted sausages over the pyre, which was dotted with burning chunks of blown-up berg. To be frank, the ceremony of Sechselauten, held every year in Zurich, used to be a little weird. But then in 2016, the Fishermen's Guild stopped throwing dead fish into the crowd during the pre-pyre parade, and now it's just a normal ceremony. It simply involves the riders circling a big pile of burning hay, at the top of which is a snowman named the Berg, whose head is packed with fireworks. If his head detonates quickly, the summer will be good. If it takes longer, the summer will be bad. But what if the Berg's head stays disastrously intact? As you know, Sechselauten takes place on the third Monday of April every year, which was this past Monday. And unlike a Swiss horse, I'm not going to beat around the Berg. Switzerland will have no summer this year. That is the only conclusion we can draw from the fact that the snowman's head did not blow up at all because it was blown out. Due to high winds, the bonfire was called off. The people of Zurich are unsettled, but are bravely carrying on as if the ceremonial snowman's unblasted head hasn't thrown their future into absolute uncertainty. And the snowman itself looks okay, despite its close call. But then again, you can't judge a berg by its cover. anti-abortion advocates celebrating in the Arizona House of Representatives today. Democrats there are trying to repeal an 1864 ban on abortions, which, thanks to an Arizona Supreme Court decision last week, could come back into effect in the state. So far, Republican leadership in the House has refused to allow a vote to repeal the law, in part because they're worried some Republican senators could flip and vote with the Democrats to throw it out. The fight will soon move on to the state Senate. Anna Hernandez is an Arizona state senator. We reached her earlier today in Phoenix.
Senator, that cheering, what does that tell you about how people in Arizona are feeling?
The people of Arizona want a clean repeal on the 1864 ban. And, you know, we have a very slim population here that wants to keep this ban in place. And I think that that is just unconscionable for us to allow that to happen here in Arizona.
We've seen Republicans in the House block efforts to even hold a vote on this. So is this game over now, or do you and others who want this repeal have a chance still to force a vote?
Yeah, absolutely not. It is not game over. You know, that was what happened in the House today. Again, they were shut down again for the third time of bringing Representative Stephanie Stahl Hamilton's bill to a vote. I still have a path in the Senate, which I will be exercising every option within the rules to be able to bring something to the floor for a vote. So we will be going to floor in a little bit, in probably in about an hour or so. So I'm ready to proceed. The Senate Democrats are ready to proceed to get this clean repeal done.
We know there are Republicans who have changed their minds on this and, you know, have said they would support a vote. They would vote in favor of repealing this. We can talk about their motivations separately, but how many do you think you can convince or do you know that you have on side?
I think the votes are there. You know, the biggest hurdle and the biggest issue is that they say that they're there and they say they support a repeal, but yet they will not join in supporting the motion to bring that vote forward.
Why?
So to me, they're not really in favor of repealing this, even though they know they're on the losing battle of this policy. And that's where we're at. So regardless of what they're saying, that they support a repeal of the 1864 abortion ban, they are still blocking the way of making this vote happen.
We spoke to an abortion doctor last week on this program as this ban was upheld by the state Supreme Court. You know, she was trying to stay focused on her work, but said, really, it's infuriating to see, as she put it, politicians playing with people's lives, you know, and so many questions and confusion from people who are looking to have abortions or need help. So what do you say to her and other providers about these political games that are going on?
You know, that is absolutely correct. There are politicians and lawmakers in the majority Republican Party that are using this as a political football and being willing to jeopardize people's lives. And I think that is so important for the people of Arizona and across the country and the world to understand that there are those of us within this legislative body that are willing to put the health and the safety of people first and not entertain in the political theater that is happening. I want them to know that we're going to keep fighting and we will continue to find every path that we have to make sure that we have a clean repeal on that 1864 ban.
So if you don't get your way today, later on today, then what happens?
You know, we go back to the drawing board and look at our further paths. But I think every day that we're in session, this will be a topic until we deliver for the majority of Arizonans that agree that government and politicians have no business in our reproductive health care choices. And that is something that, regardless of party lines, people agree with that. And we need to make that happen.
If the majority of Arizonans agree on this, that they don't want this 1864 law, why do you think Republicans, some, are pushing for it?
I think they're afraid to go against their funders and their campaigns. They have some very supportive pro-life and anti-abortion advocates that are funding their campaigns and making sure that they're elected, and I think they're afraid to go against that for fear of losing their elections. But I think that this will mobilize all voters across political spectrums to vote for people that will do the right thing and put people's lives ahead of their political ambitions.
What impact, if any, do you think it will have in November?
You know, the energy out here in Arizona around the Abortion Access Act, to get that on the ballot was already really high, you know, and we show that with the signature gathering. I think that this has moved that needle to guarantee that that ballot initiative will pass in November. And I think that Republicans need to be aware of what's going to happen in November. And I think they will realize that they are on the wrong side of history here and they should step up and do the right thing.
I'll ask you a question, Senator, that I asked the doctor last week as well. What does it say to you as a woman in Arizona that we're talking about an 1864 law when, you know, the Civil War was underway, Arizona was not a state, women lacked the right to vote, among other changes that have happened since then? What does this law say to you as a woman and other women in Arizona?
You know, it says to me that we don't matter to the majority, that they are willing to risk our lives and that they are not really about protecting life, right? That they are the party that is so pro-life, they are willing to jeopardize your health and kill you because they want to uphold these bans. It's very devastating to be a woman here in Arizona, especially as a lawmaker, and realize that I am serving with people that are not willing to put people first and willing to entertain the political circus that's happening around this.
Senator, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ana Hernandez is an Arizona State Senator. We reached her earlier today in Phoenix. Tonight, thousands of people took to the streets of Tbilisi after politicians in Georgia passed a controversial draft law. Officially, the legislation aims to rein in foreign agents and influence, but critics worry that it mirrors similar laws in Russia and will actually be used for political repression. European Council President Charles Michel has echoed those concerns, saying the bill is not consistent with the European Union's values and, quote, will bring Georgia further away from the EU and not closer, unquote. Igor Koroptev is the regional director of the Free Russia Foundation, which supports democracy in Russia. He fled to Tbilisi years ago, and that's where we reached him.
Igor, the protests are still going on. I can hear it around you as well. Just describe what you've been seeing tonight.
It's dozens of thousands of people protesting outside. Now people are also blocking the Prime Minister's office, demanding Prime Minister to come and to talk to them, to people. And of course, a major demand of all people of Georgia, I would say, because we see that it's not just some opposition activists or something, but entire country, including sports celebrities, like very famous in Europe football player from Georgia, Khvicha Kvaratskhelia, and many others are demanding Georgian government to withdraw this so-called Russian law. Mm-hmm. In Georgia, people call it Russian law, not just foreign agents law.
Foreign interference and influence is a concern in many countries. What specifically about this bill has so many people upset and in the streets, not just tonight? There have been protests before as well in recent days.
Yeah, it's very different. This law is like if you have some finance, some funds from abroad above 20%, you immediately become a foreign agent. But in U.S. and in some European countries, they also have similar law, but they're very different because it's not only about funding, it's about proof and evidence that you are the provider of foreign influence. But in Russia, the same as in Georgia now, this foreign agents bill is about your own citizens, about Georgians, about Russians, people who, for example, even have some donations. So in Russia, for example, government can put pressure or oppressions against people, even if it's some kind of charity organization that received one, I don't know, lari from Georgia, one drum for Armenia, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this way, they say that they're enemies of the state. They say that they're like spies. And the same in Georgia. So this law is directed not against some providers of foreign influence, but against local civil society, NGOs, media, independent media, of course. And in Georgia, it's a small country. It's quite a poor country. So, of course, almost all independent media and NGOs, they have grants from abroad, mm-hmm. from United States, from European Union, from United Kingdom, from Canada. So government wants to call these people enemies.
The ruling Georgian Dream Party tried to pass a similar law last year, as you well know, but there were mass protests at that time, so they dropped that measure. Why do you think they're trying again?
It's quite possible that they have a request from Russia to do so. It's quite possible because in another country, in Central Asia, in Kyrgyzstan, also like Russia's interest space, government actually already passed this bill, the same one, foreign agents. And so last year, people succeeded and they annulled this bill because they were waiting for European Union candidate status. Mm-hmm. In December, Georgian people, as European Union leadership says directly, that this status was granted to Georgian people, not the government. So in December 2023, Georgian people received this candidate status, and Georgian government doesn't need anything from European Union anymore, and they have elections in October. So,
but could it not be risking that EU candidacy? Why would they take that risk?
Yes, but they don't consider that EU, for example, will like immediately take mm-hmm. this candidacy away somehow. What they want to try to achieve, as I see it, first is if they succeed and they pass this bill, they will be able to use it for propaganda before election to say that all observing NGOs who observe elections are foreign agents and they are promoting Western interests, not Georgian, and so on and so forth. The same for media.
What does it mean for you personally, given the work that you do?
For me personally, my organization will also be marked as foreign agent because Russian exiled opposition, of course, have funds only from Western grants and no other money, maybe some donations, but it's a very small part. And lots of us, we are foreign agents in Russia. And now we will become foreign agents in Georgia. So it's like running from repression in Russia to see repression in Georgia. Of course, it's very disappointing. But Georgian people fighting, they have a struggle. And maybe as last year or many times actually before, Georgian society succeeded. And there were many huge protests in Georgia when people actually achieved the goal mm-hmm. and prime ministers resigned and so on and so forth.
So you think these protests will keep going?
These protests will keep going for 100%. People will try to do whatever they can to achieve the goal, to have this law bill annulled. In terms of government's reaction, I have no idea, because if you choose to do it the second time after you already failed with the first attempt, it means you will like go for everything to achieve your goal here, to pass it. And if they pass it, it directly means that the Kremlin's influence in Georgia like increased significantly. It's now also very big, actually huge, because mm-hmm. Georgian government has lots of economic ties with Russia, specifically after the invasion of Ukraine. But in this case, it will mean that politically, Georgia is also, unfortunately, becoming much more influenced by the Kremlin.
Will it mean that you have to run again?
Maybe. Not this specifically, but a complex of issues. This also, and if Georgia will keep on going, the Georgian government, let's divide, will keep on going the way it is doing now, most likely, yes, we will have to relocate from here as well.
Igor, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Igor Kuroptev is a democracy activist from Russia who now lives in Georgia. We reached him in Tbilisi. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.